From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Agadet. It's Friday, and it's time for our reporter roundtable when we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this week. Today, our panel includes Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Audrey Dutton, senior investigative reporter with the Idaho Capital Sun, Kelsey Mosley Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun, and Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hello.
Happy Friday.
Friday.
Yay. Okay, Kevin, I'm going to start with you and the University of Idaho murders. We got a bunch of new information this week, including an affidavit of probable cause. Tell us about what we found out this week.
Well, the affidavit filled in a lot of the blanks in terms of the case against Brian Koberger. This was the document we were kind of waiting for ever since the arrest last week. It had been sealed until Koberger had returned to Idaho. It was transported back to Idaho to actually formally face the murder charges in Idaho. And it's a really eye-opening affidavit. It is the Moscow Police Corporal's account of the events at that house on the morning of November 13th, some really chilling details. The account that one of the surviving roommates, came face to face with the attacker during the slayings. It also kind of lays out a lot of the physical evidence and the telephonic evidence against Koberger. They say that they found a DNA match that links Koberger to the crime scene. They also found cell phone records that indicated that that Koberger had been in the area near the house where the slayings took place on at least 12 occasions leading up to November 13th. But then on the morning of November 13th, his cell phone indicates that he drove over from Pullman, where he lived. He's a Washington State University student. The affidavit says that he drove over from Washington State. Then the phone either went off, was turned off, or was put into airplane mode during the time frame of the attacks. And in the affidavit, the police corporal says that that's not uncommon, that often perpetrators turn their phones off or put their phones in airplane mode to conceal their emotions. So the affidavit links Koberger to the scene through DNA evidence. It links him to the crime scene via phone records. It answers a lot of the questions that we had going into the case, and now that the case will start to unfold in the court system, it's a really sobering, really, it's a tough read, because it really puts into a lot of focus the evidence against Koberger, but also the events of November 13th.
And the DNA evidence, I think, was fascinating. A lot of people were looking to find out about that. Talk more about that DNA, not only what they found, but how they connected the DNA to the suspect.
Right. So what the police found, they found a sheath, a leather sheath to hold a knife. And they found that at the murder scene. And they found a DNA sample on the button snap of that sheath. And what police say that they did was they matched that DNA to DNA that was recovered at the Koberger family house in Pennsylvania right after Christmas. And the evidence that was recovered at the house in Pennsylvania, I believe, as I read the affidavit, I read it to mean that the DNA that was recovered at the house in Pennsylvania belongs to Koberger's father, but the odds of the DNA at the crime scene belonging to somebody who wasn't related to Koberger's father, the odds of there not being a connection between the two was infinitesimally small. So that's how I read the DNA evidence.
And also fascinating that they got the DNA evidence from the Koberger home by going through the trash, it sounded like.
Mm-hmm. Basically, and anybody who watches true crime TV, and I'm a watcher, you will see that happen in cases like this. There's no presumption of privacy when you throw trash out. You know, it is fair game for law enforcement to go through and seek DNA evidence. So, but yeah, it's an interesting twist that, DNA evidence that was recovered more than 2,000 miles away, several weeks after the attacks, that was linked to the attacks. It's a pretty fascinating development.
So we had first court date for Koberger. What happens next?
I believe that there's another hearing scheduled on January 12th. I believe that's what Angela Palermo at the Idaho Statesman reported on Thursday. You know, this is, you know, obviously, you know, the very early stages in what's going to be, you know, a very long and, you know, for those closest to this crime, a very painful legal process.
Indeed, and definitely just the beginning of the story. Kelsey, I'm going to switch to you for another very big story that happened this week. The Idaho Supreme Court came out with a ruling on Idaho's abortion laws. What did we find out there?
Yeah, I would note that these both happened yesterday.
Yeah.
It was a little bit of a full busy day.
There were a few other stories that came out yesterday as well, but we'll get there.
Mm-hmm. So this came out yesterday afternoon. We've been waiting on this since early October. And so they finally dropped it. It was a 3-2 decision to uphold Idaho's abortion ban and the civil enforcement law that is modeled after Texas's heartbeat law. And there's also the 6-week abortion ban in there, but that one's a little bit on the sideline because of the total abortion ban. But the three justices who concurred were Justice Brody, the Chief Justice, and Gregory Mueller. And the two dissenting were Stegner and Zahn. And basically what they said was that this wasn't an indictment of, you know, personal policy preferences. This is just about what's in the Constitution and how the framers in Idaho wrote it in the 1800s and what they've done since then to uphold abortion law in Idaho. And so they said they couldn't find, you know, a fundamental right to privacy that extends to abortion in our Constitution. And the two dissenting justices said that they believe this should extend to, you know, bodily autonomy and the inalienable rights of a pregnant woman to her life and safety. But the majority opinion also noted that this does not stop people from conducting a ballot initiative to get something on the ballot so that we can amend the Constitution to include this. They're just saying, you know, this is what the Constitution says at this moment. And so we can't intervene and say something else. So these laws have been on the books since August, so nothing's going to change as a result of this. And I talked to the person who kind of crafted these bills in 2020 and 2021, I think it was. And he said, you know, there's not going to be any substantive changes to these laws as they're written. If anything, they'll probably go a little bit further or try to go a little bit further in this session coming up, which starts Monday. So that's the main gist of it.
You also had reaction from Planned Parenthood, Democrats, Republicans, Dorothy Moon. What did Planned Parenthood say?
Planned Parenthood said this is a dark day for Idaho and the fight's not over. They said they'll keep fighting for everything they think that Idahoans have a right to experience and the rights to their body. And they also said that this happened the same week that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the use of a drug called mifepristone, which is the first of two pills that can be used to terminate a pregnancy, usually used before 12 weeks. And they said that their pharmacies and retail pharmacies and mail order pharmacies can dispense that. That probably wouldn't happen here because I don't think pharmacies would do that, but if you wanted to get it out of state, there's a lot of options with telehealth that I think Planned Parenthood helps people connect to. So they're seeing some hope there. The Republican Party came out with a statement that just said that the fight is not over. They're happy to see that this happened, but they want all Idahoans to be vigilant and remain committed to defending life, and Democrats came out with the counter that said, you know, the only way we can win back our reproductive freedoms is to elect Democrats across the state, and that this these bans still endanger the lives of pregnant women with medical providers, and they'll continue to fight for reproductive freedoms in the future.
Well, and as you said, these laws have been on the books for a while, so no, you know, no changes now. And it sounds like the judges said, you know, if you want change, you got to change the laws, change the Constitution, change the lawmakers.
Yep. They said, if you're not happy with this, you should take it to the ballot box and take these legislators out of the office.
All right. Okay. Dawn, the Office of Police Accountability Director saga continues. Give us some background on what's happened to this point, and then we'll dig into the story that that came out from you guys recently.
Yeah, so we've been keeping a close eye on the city of Boise and the Boise Police Department over the last 5 or 6 months. It started with revelations against Chief Ryan Lee and his the request by Boise Mayor Lord McLean to have him step down in September. And it's continued through the fall into the winter, and I expect through much of this year. In November, Boise Mayor Lauren McLean put Office of Police Accountability Director Jesus Jara on paid administrative leave, and essentially said that there were some questions about his actions in the office. Then about 2 weeks later, she took the matter to the Boise City Council, who voted 5-1 to terminate Mr. Jara from the position. 2 days later, the attorney for Jesus Jara filed a lawsuit against the city of Boise, saying a number of things, including that he was retaliated against for bringing forth issues and was protected under whistleblower statutes. And one of the things in the lawsuit that caught our eye, and in fact, the attorney for Mr. Jara, Grady Hepworth, had pointed out to us, was that the city had told me in November that they had revoked his access to some internal systems for the Boise Police. One allowed a user to see in real time where police vehicles and crews were throughout the city. And a second was the monitoring of on-body video cams, body cams. And this is key because the city said he was doing what he had termed random audits of these on-body videos, and that his department had viewed more than 8,000 videos in just about a year and a half. And so what the attorney had said is, okay, well, they cut his access off after he'd filed a grievance with the city. And that's not what they had told me. Without getting too granularly into dates, which is hard to convey on the radio, the timeline the city pointed out to me and the timeline from the lawyer didn't match up. So we went about trying to figure out, okay, what's the truth here? And is there a way to get to that? So Boise DF senior reporter Margaret Carmel and I have been filing quite a few public records requests on this. And what we found essentially was the city cut his access about 2 hours before the grievance came in. This was on November 21st. Now, that's a pretty close cutoff. And the city had told me before the lawsuit had came out, before he was formally fired, that his access had been cut on November 15th. Well, what happened is, according to the public records, so there's documentation here, is Boise Deputy City Attorney Kimberly Smith had written a memo to City Attorney Jamie Sullivan outlining her interpretation of the code and what the OPA office was doing, and that it was problematic, and suggesting, either we need to tell the department to stop because this isn't in the code, or we need to cut their access. Jamie Sullivan, city attorney, forwarded that message to Courtney Washburn, who is Mayor Lauren McLean's chief of staff, and Washburn said, cut his access. So that was on November 15th. Now you fast forward to November 21st. That's the day the access actually got cut. Now, some people will say, oh, well, maybe Haro was wrong, or was, I don't even want to say the word lying, but saying in his complaint that he was retaliated against. But looking at the audit trail, he wouldn't have actually known what time it happened, because you can actually see in the IT record exactly what time he tried to log in. So about an hour before his access was cut, he logged into the system successfully, was able to get in. His access was cut in the 3 o'clock hour. He filed the grievance in the 5 o'clock hour. And then the next morning he tried to log in and wasn't able to. So his knowledge base was that, oh, hey, I was able to log in the afternoon. I filed my grievance, and the next morning I've been locked out. And that's why we wanted to get in and see, okay, well, what exactly was the timeline here? Now, the city hasn't been able to really explain why it took almost a week from November 15th to November 21st to cut the access. We don't really still know that. We've got an outstanding question with the city as to why the delay. But it does take away a little bit of the lawsuit's assertion against retaliation. There's some other things in there, and I'm not an attorney and can't really opine any of that. But this specific thing, it sort of shows, hey, yeah, there was kind of a quirk of timing here. But it's going to be key because, you know, if they either try and get a settlement or go to court, this is something that a judge and maybe a jury would look at as to what actions and what steps the city took around the firing of this fairly high profile position within the city.
Well, and there's still this debate. You mentioned it briefly about, did the director do anything wrong? And by accessing the videos and watching the videos, and that seems to be a pretty murky topic as well.
Yeah, it does. And so KTVB Television in Boise had a story in late December that revealed a memo from July of 2021 from the aforementioned Courtney Washburn. The Channel 7 story said that it was the memo was to Jesus Haro, but we went and obtained the actual memo, and it wasn't to him. It was CC'd to him. It appeared to have been sent to some members of the public and outlined some of the focuses of the office. What the memo is silent on, so let me back up. So the memo says that the office does have access to these systems, that's unique. And that they can have direct access to police reports, videos, and OIA investigations in real time. And Washburn even says in the memo, this is rare. The memo doesn't say, and this is important, it doesn't say that his office would be doing these random audits. And so you can interpret this a couple of ways. You can say, oh, well, the city said to they'd have real-time access, but it also didn't go so far as to say that he could do audits that were outside of a complaint or like a critical incident. The city attorney's memo basically says that that's not in the ordinance, and that's kind of why this activity was asked to be curtailed. That's the rub here, is interpretation of the statute. Jesus Haro had a meeting with the mayor, Courtney Washburn, and three members of the city council. We were given notes of the kind of the loose minutes of that meeting. Now, you know, look, it's not a recording, it's not a verbatim, but it is sort of the notes of that meeting. And in those notes, it says that Haro had admitted that the ordinance was silent on whether or not his staff could look at these random videos. I don't know where this is going to go exactly. I don't know how a judge is going to rule. There have been members of the public that we have noticed that have said, hey, well, maybe he should have access. And in fact, I haven't really been able to get the city to say that maybe that's not something that should be done. That being said, they're saying that it isn't in the ordinance now. And I think that there's that tension a little bit between members of the public that would like oversight of the police to be really stringent, and others who would like oversight of the police to be less stringent. And the political leadership in the city, who I think are in a place of trying to thread that needle, not wanting to look very anti-cop, to put it frankly, but also wanting to ensure that the police have some sort of oversight. In the background here, Sam, and I know this is already a long explanation, but I think this is important, is the city, it has hired an outside investigative firm called Steptoe and Johnson to look into practices in the city's police department. This was prompted after the revelation of racist comments and participation in a white nationalist convention by a former Boise police officer by the name of Matt Bringelson. And this reporting is new on Idaho Matters. We haven't been able to put this out, and so I probably shouldn't say this, but I'm gonna anyway. We'll have a story next week. The mayor actually wrote a note to Jesus on November 29th. Our Margaret Carmel found this, saying, this investigation will also include a review of oversight functions, including the Office of Police Accountability. We expect full participation of your office. So that's kind of an interesting little tea leaf here. There's a lot going on to this, and we're going to continue to follow it. Both Margaret and I are really trying to understand the truth and tell people what we can find and bring those facts to light as we go along.
Well, it is. You have done, the two of you, a lot of digging and a lot of uncovering of information, and I highly recommend go to boisedev.com. Look at the stories on this and the others that you've been doing with the city. It's fascinating stuff.
Thanks.
Audrey, St. Luke's has a new health plan. Tell us about it. First off, what is it and how does it work?
Right. So so they debuted it on the Health Insurance Exchange. An open enrollment ended in December, and now people are who opted in for it, who chose it, are getting covered. And it is an HMO style plan. It's not the first time we've seen one of these, but I do believe it's the first one in Idaho where it belongs to a health system. So it's called St. Luke's Health Plan. It's not the same kind of HMO that you'd see with like Kaiser Permanente, but it's the same general idea. So it links together your health insurance and your healthcare provider, and they're all kind of one thing. And the plan, it has some components that we've seen in other health insurance options in Idaho. But in this case, according to the plan's president, it puts financial carrots and sticks for good healthcare and affordable healthcare. It puts those in the hands of the healthcare providers themselves. So they are in charge of a lot of the decisions, whether something's medically necessary, et cetera, but it also holds them responsible for those decisions. So it holds them responsible for how well their patients do, how much the healthcare costs. And it does this in sort of technical ways. But if you think of it as like, hey, your patients are being hospitalized way too often, or they're having really bad outcomes, we need to get this under control. It's a little bit more tightly aligned in that way. They've also promised that there won't be quite as many friction points. So I'm currently fighting with my health insurance plan administrator to get them to cover a very basic claim. And they're saying, hey, your healthcare provider didn't submit the right billing code for this, so we can't cover it. And then I'm going to the healthcare provider and they're saying, nah, that was the right code. That's the only code we can use. And so I'm stuck in the middle trying to get them to talk to each other. And so one of the things that the St. Luke's Health Plan folks are saying is that kind of the patient being either forced to spend time and energy on trying to get their claims covered or just paying it out of pocket, which I think a lot of people end up doing, they're saying that that's going to be minimized. And I think a lot of people can relate to that. So will the health plan succeed in all of these goals? Its major goal being to, control the rising cost of healthcare and improve the health of Idahoans. Will it succeed? We shall see. One of the big sticking points in healthcare costs has always been that you can't like force patients who have diabetes to keep their disease under control. You can't force people to exercise. You can only try your best to help them do that. And healthcare administrators can only do so much to empower their healthcare providers to help their patients do that. So there's a lot of kind of independent factors that are involved here. And of course, with the cost of prescription drugs, that being just one part of healthcare, but a very expensive one, that is a wild card. So it is an interesting plan, and I'm going to be watching it closely to see how it does in terms of health insurance premiums, whether they go way up or way down, how that kind of works out. But it's an interesting new plan.
It is. It'll be fascinating to see, as you said, how it shakes out. Okay. Don, back to you. Idaho 55. There are new avalanche warning signs on Idaho 55. Why?
Yeah, so that was pretty much the exact question that a Boise Dev Reader posed to us, poised to us, which one of those. They were driving through the construction zone and they saw avalanche warning signs and were like, what's up with that? So we asked our reporter, Autumn Robertson, to check on this and to ask the Idaho Transportation Department that very question. As you know, the construction zone near Smith's Ferry has been fraught. Including a large number of rock slides in the area. The project is nearly double its budget. It's well behind schedule. We had a fairly high profile investigation of this last summer by Autumn and Margaret. In fact, I understand the governor was just asked about it again this week.
He was.
And so the answer from ITD is, well, it's precautionary. John Tomlinson, who's an agency spokesperson, told her, "Our commitment to safety has not wavered on this project, and the signs are up through this construction zone for this reason. Crews will be back as soon as weather permits to complete that finishing work." He went on to say, "If potential avalanche conditions based on these measurements are identified this winter, the road may be temporarily closed and drivers diverted." So it doesn't really answer the question, other than to say that there could be avalanches here. Well, we know this, although I wouldn't necessarily consider what's happened in the past to be avalanches. We consider them to be rock slides. I mean, they're avalanches of rocks.
Yeah.
It's not an area that's known for super heavy snowpack. Obviously, there is often snow there. But the answer as to why they put the signs up, I'm going to just say, seem to be a CYA type of move that things could happen. You might as well put up a sign and let people know. I would guess by now most Idahoans know that that area is fraught, and not just because of our reporting, but because lots of news stories have been done on the four, five, six, I think, rock slides that have happened in that area, some of which closed the road for months on end. And so this has been an area that has just been a real problem for the department, and I think they're continuing to just try and figure out how to move forward here and continue to take in a lot of questions from the media, particularly us and the public.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Kevin, let's get the latest on North Idaho College. There's a new president and a new president contract. What did you find out about that?
Well, whenever we talk about North Idaho College, I always find myself saying, there's a lot going on up there, and there is a lot going on up there. A couple of weeks ago, North Idaho College hired an interim president. His name is Greg South. He had been an administrator up there for a while in the year 2021. But what I found interesting about all of this was when I got the contract for South, he's getting paid $235,000 a year. Nick Swain, who was hired as president back way back in June, 7 months ago, he was hired as president. He's on administrative leave, but it's paid administrative leave, so he's still pulling down $230,000 a year. So you add all that up, North Idaho College, a community college, is on the hook to pay its two presidents $465,000 a year. That's more than Marlene Trump makes at Boise State. That's more than Scott Green makes at the University of Idaho. That's more than Kevin Satterley makes at Idaho State University. So the administrative churn up at North Idaho College is proving to be quite expensive. And what I also found interesting about the contract is it runs until June of 2024. So this interim president has an 18-month contract, which could be extended. So it's really hard to tell exactly what the end game on the presidency at North Idaho College is. Now, never mind all the end game of everything else that's going on at North Idaho College. And I've got another story that's coming on Friday that looks a little bit further at the decision to hire an interim president and the process of hiring an interim president. It all kind of comes out in North Idaho College's response to regional accreditors. As you know, as we've talked about this before, accreditors have real concerns about the way North Idaho College is governing itself, the dysfunction and the churn that's going on up there. And they have questioned whether North Idaho College should be accredited. And that's what really affects students, Samantha. I mean, that's when students can't transfer their credits from NIC to another school. That's when students can't qualify for the state's Opportunity Scholarship because you have to be attending an accredited school to get that state scholarship. So the accreditation is the big deal. And that's why we continue to cover this story and we continue to cover all the intrigue surrounding NIC, because you have regional accreditors saying, we may pull your accreditation. And this week, the college had to respond to this latest threat and try to lay out their case for why they should not be, why they should not have their accreditation pulled.
And I read that in the story. They had a deadline where they had to basically send a letter that says, please keep us accredited.
Right. The response was due on Wednesday. The college made it public on Thursday. And as Kelsey mentioned, we had a lot of news on Thursday, so I didn't really get much of a chance to dive into the response. There's some interesting stuff there. I have a story that's coming out on Friday that breaks down that response.
Got it. All right, Kelsey, the Idaho Republican Party State Central Committee could change some of its rules this weekend. And I think the most interesting one seems to be about, if I read this right, punishing officials who deviate from the party platform.
Yeah, there's three kind of major rules that they're considering at the winter meeting today and tomorrow. I think it's later today and tomorrow. And this is kind of, you know, inside baseball type stuff because it's very detailed information about how they're governing themselves as a political party. I think some people think that political parties have to be beholden to, you know, laws. And a lot of times they don't because they function as a club. And so they can kind of do what they want in terms of how they function and how they allow people to call themselves Republicans. And this is, this rule that I wrote about for yesterday's edition was pertaining to people who can call themselves Republicans. There's a lot of concern in the party about accountability for elected officials who say that they will uphold the party platform, because I think it's in the GOP bylaws or something that you pledge to uphold the platform if you fill out the GOP's surveys and things like that. And so there's quite a few things in the platform that some Republicans would not say that they believe in, like returning to the gold standard of currency or, you know, repealing the 16th Amendment, which is the federal government's ability to tax. You know, some would agree with that and some would not. And so there's this movement to create a rule that would allow the respective committees, based on the position that you're talking about. So like the State Central Committee could be responsible for U.S. senators and U.S. representatives and state officials and their conduct. And if they strayed too far from something that they deemed appropriate, they could call that person to what amounts to a tribunal of these committee members and be censured, or, you know, let them have their say and explain themselves. But if they need to be disciplined, they could be censured for the first time and, you know, guided as to what they should be doing in the future. And if they did it a second time, they could be barred from using Republican signifiers in their future elections. So you wouldn't be able to use the Republican name when you ran in the future. And that's a pretty big deal in a state like Idaho, where that is kind of everything when you are a Republican running in Idaho, because that is what people look for. And so they would fall, if you were like a legislative person, it would be a legislative committee that would allow, that would be able to call that meeting. And if you were a county official, it would be the county central committee. So it's giving a lot of power to people who a lot of voters don't even know exist in a lot of ways, and don't know who those people are. And the people that I've talked to who are against it say, you know, this is something that's taking away power from voters who already have the say on whether somebody gets to be reelected and gets to be a Republican, their nominee. So, but there's also the faction that believes this is what you sign on for when you want to be a Republican. You have to uphold the things that all of the delegates have said is our platform. And so that's kind of a big one. And then the crossover voting proposal will also be considered this weekend, which is about allowing people to vote in the Republican primary, which is closed to only Republican registered voters. And there's a rule that would disallow people from voting in the Republican primary if they haven't been a Republican for 2 years prior to that election. That's assuming they were affiliated with a different party before. If you're just a new voter, then you can still vote in their primary. But these are the contentious ones for sure. And they're also considering stripping voting rights from a few of the organizations tied to the Republican Party, the Young Republicans, the College Republicans, and the Federation of Women, Idaho Republican Women. And there's a lot of speculation that this is all politically motivated, all about which political allegiances are fighting with each other in the party. And so it could be a very contentious winter meeting. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, we'll have to see what happens next week after the conference. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Dawn, we've only got about 8 minutes left, so I know we can't go everywhere with this, but Avamore wants to become part of the City of Eagles. Start with, what is Avamore? Where is Avamore? And why is this a problem?
Avamore is a piece of land owned by the McLeod family that sits on the triangular border of Ada, Gem, and Boise counties. You drive through it if you go to McCall before you hit that avalanche zone. And it is a development that already has a lot of homes in it and could have as many as 8,000 homes in it when all is said and done. Long term, they need to be annexed into a city, and part of that is because of that unique sort of three-county setup. They've been approved to start building homes in Boise County, but they would also, I think, like to get into the Gem County side as well. This was the basis of a lawsuit by the city of Boise about 15 years ago or so, under former Boise Mayor Dave Beter, saying, we don't want Avamore in Boise. And they have been angling to be annexed into City of Eagle. You said you don't want me to go everywhere, but I will say that the developers and the money behind Avamore spent a fairly significant sum to back the ousting of the former Eagle mayor in favor of current mayor Jason Pierce, as well as several of the city council members. So it's made people cast an eye towards that political leadership to wonder if it's a rubber stamp. And of course, they have said no, it's not a rubber stamp. They will follow their what they need to do. It's now going to planning and zoning in Eagle. If the planning and zoning team gives that the go-ahead, it likely goes to the city council. What's interesting here is that Mayor Jason Pierce and some of those city council seats are up for re-election this year. And so they're under a little bit of time pressure if they are the ones to vote. And then the city of Eagle, the voters in the city of Eagle are going to get a fairly quick way through to say, if they want to keep those leaders or switch horses.
So what does Avamore get out of annexation, and why is it not necessarily a good idea for cities? I'm guessing there's money involved in paying for things.
Well, yeah. So for Avamore, they want to be in one city because they then can have, you know, municipal systems and police and some of those things covered by one agency versus sort of a complicated setup because they're in multiple counties. You can think of the city of Star, which is on the border between Ada and Canyon. And I also believe the city of Cuna, if I'm not if I'm not mistaken, is on the Ada Canyon border. They're one city, even though they go over one county, which gives them one municipal government. Avamore kind of wants the same sort of setup in Eagle. Frankly, Eagle and Boise are the only two cities that, that they could be annexed into. And there are people who have a problem with this. There's been some kind of back and forth on analysis to what it would cost taxpayers of the current existing city of Eagle. Avamore basically says that they can't grow their full potential without this annexation. And so it's going to be a key issue. 8,000 homes is a lot of homes, and it's one of a number of, you know, I think the Statesman called it a mega development. We don't generally use those types of terms, but I think it's apt. Even though we don't use them, I think it's right. 8,000 houses is a lot of houses. And so how this all shakes out is going to be key, not just really, frankly, for the city of Eagle, but for the growth of the entire Treasure Valley at large, and whether we see some additional urban sprawl towards that and traffic issues on I-55 and others.
Okay. And I believe there's a public hearing coming up.
Yep. They're planning zoning, I believe, later this month.
Okay. We want to thank everybody that we have been talking to today. Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News. Audrey Dutton, senior investigative reporter with the Idaho Capital Sun. Kelsey Mosley-Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun. And Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com. We're going to put up a bunch of links to a lot of their stories on our website, BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Godin. You're listening to Idaho Matters.
Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts.
This new year, LifeKit wants to help you succeed, because everyone needs a little help being human.
It can seem so overwhelming. You're not alone.
Who can I commit to being?
If you want to do something, then just do it. Just take that first step.
Great advice every week. Listen to LifeKit from NPR.